thank you all so much for being here today. I know it's hard to give up a Saturday, especially right now with this weather. It's amazing. I have a friend of mine here, Joe Komarak from Minneapolis, Minnesota. So he's actually really grateful to be here this weekend. he happened to be planning a trip, and it just coincided with this event today. He had plans today and had kind of rearranged the schedule so he could be here, but he's the executive director of the organization that I serve with full-time, Faith Search International, is a ministry based in Minneapolis, and you can see their visitor website if you like, but it was founded by a couple of intellectuals, a scientist, and a seminary pastor kind of guy, and their goal was to do evangelism. That's what they wanted to do. They wanted to fulfill the Great Commission. We want to reach the lost. But as a scientist, they realized that we live in a very secular, skeptical culture. We don't live in a religious culture. And it's important that we address the questions that people have when you try to do evangelism. I remember when I first went through my Campus Crusade training, years and years in the mid-90s, on how to share the gospel using what they call the four spiritual laws. It's a little tract that they've used for a long, 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 long time to share the gospel. And I remember thinking, okay, I've spent a lot of time dialoguing with people, witnessing, sharing my faith. These are the kinds of things that people would say if I were to share this presentation. So when I was going through the training, they would start off by saying something like, God loves you and offers you a wonderful plan for your life, as it says in the first law. And then I would say, well, wait a minute, God, I don't, what do you mean by that? Like, what is God? And so on. And then they kept wanting me to go through the presentation. Well, don't worry about those kind of questions. Just get through the presentation. You know, man is sinful and separated from God. Well, what do you mean by sin? You know, like immoral? Like, I don't agree that I'm a sinner. I mean, that's sort of a religious idea. And no matter what I said, the person training me kept saying, well, you know, just hold those questions to the very end. Okay. And they're training me to do this presentation. They weren't actually trying to witness to me. I was already a believer, a brand new believer. Not brand new, but pretty new. And as I got to the end, she says, okay, then you want to take them through the prayer. Would you like to pray to receive Christ? And I just was scratching my head thinking, why in the world would I want to do that? You've ignored every single question that I've had. And as Dr. Byerly, one of the founders, who's the author of the text for today, Surprised by Faith, that we'll be using primarily as our text for this morning's and afternoon's presentation, he would often say that the heart cannot accept what the mind rejects. And I thought to myself, you honestly want me to ask people to pray and believe in Christ, and yet you've offered no evidence for these four spiritual laws. So it was his motivation nearly 40 years ago to launch this ministry, to present the gospel as an evangelistic tool, as a presenter, as an evangelist, to partner with local churches, but utilizing the evidences, the reasons incorporated into. So if I were to go back and take that four spiritual laws and do it in light of the vision that this ministry has, is every time I would go through the one law, I would say, okay, now here's all the reasons why I believe that this law is true, and then move on to the next one. So I'm going to kind of do that today. I'm going to hope to, at least, anyway. When I started the ministry, when I was in my early 20s, I started traveling overseas right away, and I came across a lot of interesting individuals from different backgrounds, you know, different religions. And so right away, I was doing a lot of events. You know, I was just a magician, and I just wanted to share my faith. And I started off with that simple four spiritual laws, much like Dr. Byerly. When he came to faith, he started off with that simple gospel message and realized that if I want to reach people, I have to be able to answer their questions. And so I thought, well, it'd be neat to do Q&A whenever I'm on a university campus. So I would do my gospel presentation, as you can see in the next image. I'd always do a visual gospel illustration whenever I'd share with an audience, whether it be high school students or college students. And then at the end, I would do a Q&A time. And these were hard, really hard, because I was in my early 20s, mid-20s, you know, sort of still pretty new in my faith. And here I'm getting hammered by professors and college students. In fact, I remember one time I was doing an event in the middle of India, and this professor stood up and came to the microphone to ask his question, and he announced himself as, I am a professor from Oxford, and I thought, I'm a magician from Arizona. So, there. Can you do a coin trick? I bet you can't. And quickly I realized that I needed to study and I needed to find the reasons for why I believe, which was the process I had already been going through. So this is all happening sort of simultaneously from the time I was 19 years old all the way up until these first mission trips I did back in the mid-90s. And it's been quite an adventure. But when we ask the question about what we believe and why we believe, it really comes down to Jesus Christ. Because that's what Christianity is about. It's about following Jesus. So we're going to focus on that today. As Bo mentioned, throughout the course of the year, we'll handle different peripheral issues relating to what I'll talk to you today, but it'll be fresh material every time. So we're going to try to cover with an emphasis on why Jesus. Now, of course, it's a loaded question, but I too was a skeptic. I was raised in a non-religious home. My dad is, to this day, as far as I know, is an atheist or an agnostic, depending on his mood that time of the week. And when I first heard the gospel, I felt very much like Thomas, where I thought, well, if I only could just see for myself, if I could just know for sure, then then I would believe. It'd be so much easier if I could just sort of have a museum display of everything I needed to know, all the facts and all the data, and boom, that would sell it for me. But that's not reality, unfortunately. So we're going to start with, we're going to try to tackle six lines of evidence or six discoveries that we're going to cover today. We're going to try to cover in our brief time together. Seems brief. I mean, it seems long, but it's when you're actually going through this material, the time will fly. So we're going to go through six lines of evidence, six discoveries that I think will help you in dialoguing with friends, perhaps even affirming or reassuring you in your own faith. And so as we go through these, some of them will be direct reasons why we believe, and others will be sort of good arguments to consider faith in general, which is what this first one's going to deal with. Why am I here? The first module we'll talk about God. We're basically over the course of the year we're going to be building a cumulative case. When it comes to faith, it's not like you can prove faith, prove beyond a shadow of a doubt in one argument. I can't just say blah 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 blah. See, boom, proof. And that's not how apologists defend the Christian faith. It's a cumulative, several different lines of evidence that we point to, that when you examine all the evidence, you come to the conclusion that the most reasonable explanation is that it's true. In light of all the evidence, what is the most reasonable explanation? Whenever I talk to people, I always ask them this question. I say, what would it take? What kind of proof would it take for you to believe? I'll ask them, what do you believe? And then they'll say, well, I don't believe in this, and I don't believe what you believe, and here's what I do believe. And then I'll ask them, is that for prejudicial reasons? Is it a bias? Or is it for emotional reasons or intellectual reasons? Because this helps me understand where they're coming from. And it usually takes people back when I ask them that. They think, I never thought of that. And sometimes people will say, well, all of them, I guess. And then I'll ask them next, which approach is more likely to lead you to truth? Emotional? I just feel that it's not true. Or a bias? You've already made up your mind. Don't confuse me with the facts. Or an intellectual approach. And most people would agree. Well, yeah, obviously an intellectual or scientific historical approach would be the best way to discover truth. And I said, okay, now have you done that with your views? And let's take a look. I'll give you an example. I was on a train in South Asia, and I got my laptop out. It was going to be a 3.5-hour train ride, and I pop out my laptop, and I'm going to watch a movie. Wolverine, I think it was. I was like, oh, I got my Bose headphones, plug it in. I've been doing 3 shows a day. I'm tired. I'm going to just kind of kick back. And all of a sudden, plop, right next to me, this guy sits down. He goes, hey, how are you? He knows I have headphones on. I don't know why he's talking to me, but hey, how are you? What are you doing here? Because I was like the only white guy on the train. And I said, well, I'm just here on business. Great. Are you a Muslim? No, I'm a Christian. Why? Lord, I want to watch Wolverine. Put him down. Well, I'm a Christian because I believe that Christianity is true. Have you read the Quran? And on the entire train ride, the train hadn't even left yet, and we started this conversation, the entire train ride, and I remember asking him, well, why do you believe in the Quran? If you believe it because you were raised that way, because you were born in Saudi Arabia? He was actually a professor at a university in Saudi Arabia, happened to be traveling and happened to be sitting right next to me on this train. And I happened to have my laptop, so I pulled out this presentation, which I'll go over the section that I went through with him to demonstrate to him that the New Testament had not been changed. And it was just one of those situations where I was able to apply what I'm sharing, is that I asked him, you know, do you believe it for intellectual reasons? Is it an emotional thing or is it a bias? And he had to stop and think, I don't know. Obviously for intellectual reasons. All right, then let's look at the facts. So why do we believe in God, though? What is a good motivation? How can we know whether or not there is a God? Is there even a way to know that in the knowing sense? Or is it really just an emotional response that we have? Or are we just biased towards believing in God? So what I want to do is I first want to set up a need. I want to help us understand why believing in God is important. It's not just whether there's not enough evidence or not. So I want you to imagine that the screen is all of reality right now. Just kind of want to picture in your mind that the screen is all of reality, and that's all there is. There's nothing outside of the screen. There's nothing inside the screen. So for this illustration, currently nothing exists. Yeah, we can say that there's a space, but even that doesn't exist. There's nothing in the space. There's nothing outside the space. This is sort of nothingness. So, and you know what nothing is, right? It's what Aristotle said that rocks think about. That's the definition of nothing. Now, we are going to create something to give our screen here, our nothingness, our non-existence, a purpose, an existence. So what should we throw in the screen that could give meaning to something existing? Because right now, nothing exists, so even the word existence is meaningless because nothing exists. You've seen this before. So I snap my fingers like an illusionist, and boom, we make dirt appear on screen. So there's nothing outside the screen, but what's inside the screen? Good, you guys are paying attention. There is dirt. Now, when it comes to the issue of why am I here, is there meaning and purpose in life, let me just ask you very, very briefly and throw out your answers. What is the purpose of this dirt that we have on our little mock creation here? Sorry? Well, right now we have no concept of what that is because no man exists. All that exists is dirt. In other words, it's matter. That's all that exists. So we can't say that it's for something that doesn't exist. So would it have any purpose then if it's just floating dirt out in the middle of nothingness? Right. Ultimately, the dirt has no purpose. So let's give it purpose. What is a great purpose for dirt? You can grow stuff with it. Yeah, what would be a great thing to grow that we have a real hard time keeping alive here in Arizona? Yes, grass is a great thing to grow. So let's create some grass. And I'm getting good at that. And now we have a purpose for the space, is to create things like dirt. The dirt now has an ultimate purpose, and that is to grow life, plant life. We have grass there, but we can grow anything we want, you know, trees, flowers, anything you want. So what's the purpose of the dirt? And what's the purpose of the stuff that we grow? In this example, the grass. What is the purpose for the grass? Don't say golf. Sorry? Well, what is it going to feed? Nothing else exists. So the grass can't have the purpose to feed something if there's nothing other than grass and dirt inside our creation. Well, that'd be neat if grass provided oxygen, but it actually doesn't. It needs oxygen, but it doesn't. It needs carbon dioxide. You're right. Okay, so yeah, it provides. But for oxygen for who though is would be the question. So let's give it some purpose then. What can we? What's a great purpose for grass? You said eating. What eats lots of grass? All right. So we'll just survey says. Hey, good thing. You guys got it right. Cows, yeah. We got some cows. So now we have a purpose for the dirt, to grow grass. And we have purpose for the grass, and that is to feed biological life, animal life, in this case, cows. So what's the purpose for the cows? So their purpose is so the grass is there to feed the cows, and the cows are there to fertilize and eat the grass. So it's, but this sort of circular meaning, it's not really like an ultimate meaning. There's no like real genuine ultimate meaning for the cows. And that would be kind of a bleak existence just to exist to eat grass every day. Here's what's missing, is if we're going to create something like this, we need something that has the ability to approve all the aesthetic qualities of what's inside. We need something that has an intellect, a will, emotions, something that can take the dirt and actually creatively do things with it, like make buildings, something that we can take care of the cows. What do we know of that does that? People. That's what's missing. That's why everything in our creation doesn't have an ultimate meaning and purpose, is because we don't have people in there. People give an ultimate purpose for this environment because people are sort of unique, separated. They're unlike any other creature there, so that gives everything sort of like an ultimate goal, like, wow, the reason this is all here is to give people a responsible, nice place to live. A responsibility to take care of it. So let's go ahead and throw some people there. Now on my laptop, the grass doesn't disappear. But when we transferred it, the grass vanished. That could be one of two reasons. One, bad technology, or people just destroy everything. That's what I'm often told anyway. So now we have a purpose for the not only the dirt, the grass, and the cows for each other, but an ultimate purpose for everything, and that is to appreciate the creation. So now the dirt has a purpose, the grass has a purpose, and even the cows have the purpose. So now what's the purpose of the cows? Oh, to feed the people. So we're going to grill some steaks. I love steak, and that's probably a good purpose for the cow. But I have to ask this question, though. What is the purpose for people? See, the problem with our little creation is that it doesn't have... Here's the problem. Go ahead and go on to the next slide if it'll go. Oh. he should have come. Yeah, steaks. That's what he thought. Okay, so go on to the next one, if you would. So here's our problem. Now we're going to just shrink down our creation. Imagine this is our creator. There's nothing outside of this creation that we've made. And if you think about it, this is really our universe. The dirt is really symbolizes the periodic chart of the elements. The grass represents the plant world. The cows represent the zoological world, and then, of course, you have Homo sapiens sapiens, the human species. And the reason why it's hard to find an ultimate meaning and purpose for everything that we've sort of created is because, first, it's finite. Everything is temporary, and will pass away. And it is dependent. Everything inside our little creation is dependent upon something else for its existence and for its meaning and purpose. So no matter how many other finite dependent items we put in there, whether it be golf, movie theaters, children, everything will end, and everything is dependent upon something that will end to provide ultimate meaning and purpose. And so the question really is, what is the ultimate meaning and purpose of our lives if soil, plants, animals, and people are all that exists? And the real answer to that is nothing. This is a view known as either materialism. In fact, we have a couple terms that for you to put in the back of your brain for when we talk about atheism. The first is secular humanism. You can get that up. Is it going to pop up? Oh, it skipped it, didn't it? Okay, that's okay. This is known as the view of materialism. There's nothing that exists outside the material world. The universe is closed. Nothing exists outside of the universe. We're all there is. And so upon this view, human beings don't have any essential value, don't have any genuine meaning and purpose for their lives. We don't have an objective basis or a rule of thumb, I guess you could point to, for objective moral values. So essentially, even our decisions don't have any ultimate meaning and purpose. I mean, you could be a guy who spends his entire life just pushing a rock down the street. Or you could be a physicist or Mother Teresa, and no one could ultimately look at the guy who just spends his life pushing a pebble down the street and Mother Teresa and say there is a genuine value difference in what they're investing their time in. Yes, there may be for some, well, you know, Mother Teresa helped me, I was an orphan, great. But in the ultimate sense, as Nietzsche said, since man is his end is nothing, he is nothing. And the more I wrap my mind around it, when I was growing up, being raised in the home of an atheist, the more I came to the conclusion that, wow, life does kind of mean nothing in light of this idea that if there's nothing outside of the universe, I could do whatever I want. And it wouldn't really matter. I could invest my life in helping people and doing this and that. But in the end, it's all going to die. It's all going to come to an end. In fact, there was this real funny video that I saw on YouTube that I thought we would share. It's this comedy show that people are really popular. It's becoming really popular, and I just popped that up real quick.
Here's a challenge. I want you to believe what I'm about to tell you. Not just hear it, not just understand it, but believe it. It's a fact that you already know to be true, but have never been able to fully accept. And it's this. You are going to die. You, the person listening to me right now, are going to die. It's difficult even to imagine, isn't it? Take a moment and try to picture what it's like to not exist. You can't do it. You're imagining darkness, black. But there will be no black. There will be no color because there will be no you to perceive it. And your mind recoils from that idea. It's simply unable to conceive of its own non-existence. And so it concludes that it's impossible, that you'll live forever. But you won't. All things end, all motion slows, all heat becomes cold. Life is an eddy in that current of entropy, a brief chemical reaction that lights up the darkness and then, its fuel spent, dissipates back to nothing. Just like you will. Your body is a marvelous and intricate machine built out of millions of interconnected, fragile systems. And as you age, each begins to slowly but surely deteriorate and break down. When one fails, a doctor may be able to repair it, but at some point, there will be too many interlocking failures to proceed. And like a cascade of dominoes, your joints, your eyes, your heart, your lungs, your memory, your entire body will fail. It will happen. And while it's difficult to hear this truth, it is essential that you accept it. Because every second that goes by in which you don't is a second of your precious and finite life that you risk wasting. So I'm going to say it once more, and this time try as hard as you can to believe me. You, yes, you will die. And there is nothing you can do to stop it. How's that?
What the f***?
Too much?
Yeah, that's a lot for a first date.
Yeah.
So, obviously, it's a comedy show, and...
Maybe I shouldn't.
This character, what he does in every episode is he just questions the things that we assume every day. It's very popular. It started off as an internet homemade video type of thing. It became so popular that they actually... He's a comedian, and they gave him his own show on cable. And so he just does things like this, and I don't watch the show. In fact, I had never heard of it until someone shared this clip with me, and I thought, wow, that's really serious. I was really taken in, and all of a sudden I realized he's just describing to this friend of his what he would like to talk about on a first date. So you can see how they poke fun at things that we all sort of ignore. And so it's funny, but at the same time, it's poignant, because what he said is genuinely – what our secular humanists and atheist fellow human beings would have us believe is that, you know, in the end we die. And as Nietzsche said, if man's end is nothing, he is nothing. Just think about what some of the most famous 19th century atheistic philosophers and authors were saying. I mean, they would rewrite plays in light of this view. Like Albert Camus and Jean-Paul Sartre, you'd have the curtains open and there'd just be a pile of trash with a baby crying in the background, and then the curtains would close and that would be it. These kinds of things, just displaying or pointing to the reality that life is hard and then you die. And that's it. It's all over. Did you have a question? Well, the whole point he was trying to make is that in the end, if you don't have the beginning of knowledge, which is the fear of the Lord, which comes with it the assumption of belief and faith in God, but the knowledge of God starts with a reverence, a acknowledgement of who he is as creator and in his existence. If you ignore all that, then it is... Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die. It's kind of no-brainer. And so that is our first discovery, our first line of evidence is death is the ultimate and final conqueror if, and this is the big if, the finite world is all there is. Now, this isn't necessarily a positive argument for belief in God. This is what you would call a negative argument for belief in God. But it's nonetheless... a strong motivation to say, this is an important question. It's not to say, this doesn't matter, you know, whether I believe in UFOs or not. It's, you know, I don't really care. It's not, it's a much greater issue than that, which is why 95% of the world's population believe in some sort of afterlife, a creator, a divine being or divine beings or a divine self. A spiritual reality, something that takes this life and keeps going, whether, you know, it be Hinduism or Buddhism or whatnot. So let's, in the next section, what I want to do is I want to propose an infinite answer. And we're going to look at just two fingerprints of a purpose and meaning giving life, giving God. And so we're going to look at just two. I didn't want to rob too much fun from the time that we cover atheism. We'll cover a lot more intellectual arguments for God's existence, pros and cons for why atheism or even agnosticism fails as a worldview or a philosophy. But in general, I want to just look at two. The first one is, let's just obviously imagine our creation again. And I can put a God up there, but me putting a circle with the letters God doesn't make it real. But it does beg the question, what if there is a God who created the world for a purpose? If this is something that exists eternally and exists outside of the universe, that doesn't require a cause for its existence, its necessities of its very being, could give ultimate meaning and purpose to everything that's inside our creation, inside the universe. Because you need two basically essential elements for meaning and purpose in life. Eternity, and our moral actions have to be, we have to be responsible for our moral actions. So what kind of God would we need in order to have something that would qualify as a purpose and meaning-giving God? And if you have the book, you can follow along. There's little page numbers at the bottom of the screen. Not all the time, but as we go throughout, it'll kind of give you an idea of where we are in the text, in case you happen to pick up the book and wanted to make some notes in the margin, questions you might have. But just bear with me for a moment. When we think of God, what is the first thing that comes to mind? Yeah, God is forever. He's non-beginning and non-ending. He just is. As he said to Moses, I am. I am that I am. I am the necessary existence. In philosophy, you have two kinds of existences, contingent existences and a necessary existence. A contingent existence is something that its existence depends upon something outside of itself. It's dependent. So we're all contingent. You are all dependent upon something else for your existence, families, parents, so on and so forth. And everything else in a world of causality is dependent upon some other cause. Now, a necessary existence is something that does not have a cause for its existence. It is necessary. It is the first cause, the uncaused first cause. And in philosophy, you can't have, in the real world, an infinite number of contingent existences. So, you know, some will argue, well, what if our universe had a beginning, and therefore it must have a cause, the principle of causality. Anything that comes to be must have a cause. So the universe we know came to be. Everything we know about astrophysics and cosmology screams at us that the universe has not always been. And so they try to craft theories to give the universe eternality so that they can avoid the principle of causality. So they'll say, well, there could be an infinite number of universes. But in philosophy, a good philosopher will tell you can't have an infinite number of contingent existences, because I could have, let's say, call them chocolates in a factory, and say there's no factory, there's chocolates that just keep coming out. Well, what's causing each chocolate? Well, I don't know. I don't need to answer that, because there's an infinite number of chocolates. They just keep popping out. Well, I can't cause something without having a factory. I can't make one chocolate appear out of nothing, let alone an infinite number. Just by adding infinity doesn't make it all of a sudden logically possible to create all these chocolates. I still need what's called a necessary existence, something that is independent of the contingent existence, that its existence does not require a cause. Does that make sense? That's as heady as I'm going to get, I promise. So we definitely need infinity, and there are several worldviews that actually have an idea of infinite divineness. The Eastern religions, as you can see, like Hinduism and Buddhism. There we go. So we have Hinduism and Buddhism. These are what's called monotheistic religions. I'm sorry, monistic religions. monotheistics later. Monism is the idea that all reality is one. Monists don't pray because praying assumes an I-you relationship. And the entire goal of these Eastern beliefs, ultimately, is to recognize that there is no I-you in reality. There's just I. And when you pass on your physical self, you simply become one with the energy that is called the universe. There's nothing that transcends the universe. The universe is divine, but it's a physical and a spiritual reality. So there's an infiniteness to it because it's spiritual, and the universe didn't begin to exist. It just changes in form for all eternity. And when we die, we just recognize that, in order to pass on, we just have to recognize that I am not an I. I am the I. It's kind of weird, but there's a huge problem with that. We are relational beings. We are independent selves. How could something independent and self with selfness exist in a universe that no such concept exists? So we also need our God to be personal. Now, in the Western mythical religions, there are tons of personal deities. And most of them aren't even infinite. They were created by some other deity. And the problem with these stories and why we're not talking about the Greco-Roman deities, the God of the sun, the God of the stars, the God of this, the God of that, is because, well, these are really just people giving a higher status, and they have just as many problems as other people have. They're always fighting and killing each other and arguing and cheating on each other, and they're really just deifications of human beings. What we really need, in order to really have something that would, a picture of God that would genuinely give meaning and purpose to our lives, is a divine creator, a necessary existence that's both infinite and personal, transcendent and eminent. Eminent means to be intimately involved in the creation, not like deism, which is God sort of, created the universe and like a soccer ball kicked it out and went, good luck to y'all, and has no involvement with us whatsoever. That's not what we're saying. He's infinite, meaning he exists outside the universe. He transcends all reality, but he's also eminent. He's intimately involved. So that's the picture we're looking at. And I want to give to you a little parable of an atheist, Dr. Anthony Flew, that he gave. And we'll put it up on the screen as well. But he was an atheist, and he came up with this really clever parable to sort of argue against this idea that there could be an infinite personal creator out there. Now, again, imagine the screen here is our creation. And here's his little parable. It's really clever. Once upon a time, two explorers came upon a clearing in the jungle. In the clearing were growing many flowers and many weeds. One explorer says, some gardener must tend this plot. The other disagrees. There is no gardener. So they pitch their tents and set a watch. No gardener is ever seen. But perhaps, the believer replies, he is an invisible gardener. In other words, maybe we just didn't see him. So they set up a barbed wire fence. They electrify it. They patrol with bloodhounds. But no shrieks ever suggest that some intruder has received a shock. No movements of the wire ever betray an invisible climber. The bloodhounds never give cry. Yet the believer is not convinced. He sees his gardener. He says, but there is a gardener. Invisible, insensible to electric shocks, a gardener who comes secretly to look after the garden, which he loves. At last, the skeptic despairs. But what remains of your original assertion? This is great. Just how does what you call invisible, intangible, eternally elusive gardener differ from an imaginary gardener, or even no gardener at all? So you can see the point of this atheist's parable is we talk about God, this infinite and personal being that exists, that is looking after our lives, who is intimately involved in the creation, and yet when someone asks, well, where is he? Well, he's here. He's just invisible, intangible. And that's the whole point of his parable. He's saying, this is what you're asking me to believe. And again, he says, how does an invisible, intangible, eternally elusive gardener or creator differ from just an imaginary one? Or no creator at all? So our first fingerprint is, what was it that the believer saw in the garden that told him there must be a gardener? Can you tell me? It was a tended garden. Now, what does a tended garden tell you? What is it? What are you extracting from that visual change in nature that's telling the believer, yeah, but there has to be one. Look. What is he asking? He's asking him to look at design. And when we say design, we mean there's obviously intelligence involved. Now, what was it that he saw that gave him that intimation, that idea? And we're going to talk about that as our first fingerprint. Now, here's what the atheists like to say. For example, Richard Dawkins, he says, now faith, because we're talking about faith here, is a plunge into an abyss of nonsense. All religion is superstition, and faith breeds ignorance, oppression, and strife. Their idea is that, you know, to suggest such things and to even suggest that there is a gardener is really the great delusion and ought to be just tossed out altogether. And secular humanists will tell you this is the humanist view of God. We believe that traditional theism, especially faith in the prayer-hearing God, assumed to live and care for persons, to hear and understand their prayers and to be able to do something about them, is an unproved and outmoded faith, straight out of the Humanist Manifesto. So what we want to ask is, how can I know a personal God, a creator God exists? And we're going to answer the question by, number one, by seeing the clear evidence of intelligent design in nature. And this is really quite fascinating. And there's so many different ways that we can approach this, and I'm going to try to be as brief as I can so we can move on. So when we see the natural world, when we see phenomena, we see anything in the natural world, typically there are only about three explanations. One, we can say that it is a law that explains it, like gravity. You know, every time I throw something up in the air, it falls. And so with a law, you have a high probability that the event will occur, and it'll occur repeatedly. That's how we do scientific testing of things. We test laws by repeatability. Every time I do this, this seems to happen, so it becomes a law. And then there's another phenomena called chance. Sometimes things happen by chance. Like, for example, if I'm playing a dice game and I get a Yahtzee, well, there wasn't a law in nature that says you will get Yahtzee so many throws. No, every time I throw the dice, it's 100% chance. There's no law in the universe that will help me guarantee that I will throw all sixes of the six dice in Yahtzee. So chance, though, does explain some things. You know, sometimes people accidentally bump into each other. Or they get in a car accident. These things do happen, and they're usually not as probable as events that occur by physical laws. But there's something true about both, and these are undirected causes. There's not a gravity God out there making sure that gravity is always working, nor is there a chance elf making sure that everything is completely random and by chance all the time. That's the whole definition of chance, is that it's undirected. There's no intelligence behind it. It's random. And then finally, design. There are phenomena we can see in our reality that is clearly caused by design. And these are slightly less probable events, but they're directed. And here's a couple of examples that we want to look at. Look at this next image and tell me what, offhand, what is the first thing that you think you see? First of all, what are we looking at? and with the emphasis on the first part, mount. So we're looking at a mountain. We're looking at something in nature, right? We're not looking at a car or a building. It's not clearly something that was originally put there by man. But what is it about it that makes it seem different than other mountains? Now, this is, would you consider something that's highly improbable? I mean, you can't go to mountains all over the world and see this kind of phenomena happening, right? It's not something, so it's very improbable for something like this to happen. But it did happen, right? Now, what makes us think that there's design involved rather than law or chance? Like, let's say it was a physical law. If there was something that was a law that in the universe that caused these sorts of things to happen, then we would, remember, physical laws have high probability. So that means we should be seeing this sort of phenomena happen all the time. We should be able to recreate it in a lab. And yet, I don't know that there's anything quite like this anywhere on planet Earth. On the moon, yes, there's a big face on the moon, right? You guys all knew that, right? So what makes this unique, not only, wouldn't you say it's complex? It's not just, like, simple. It's complex. But what makes it unique? Not only is it complex because you can identify features that are familiar, but isn't what else is there about it? Isn't there a recognizability? You actually know who those people are, don't you? Because there's a complexity there, but it's also specified. Not only is it specified, it's highly specified to the point where certain individuals on planet Earth would immediately recognize content. Now, no one would say this happened by chance, that rain erosion over thousands of years slowly eroded the rock to display those faces. Nobody would ever say that. So clearly, this is designed. So when we give our options, we say, okay, law, chance, or design. Which one is it? Clearly, it's design. This was caused by intelligence. No one would ever dispute that, right? I mean, we're safe to say that that's the case. Now, when people dig up in the ground, anthropologists and geologists and paleontologists, what are they looking for when they dig in the ground? Looking for patterns. Now, a geologist is looking at patterns to understanding how random nature works. But a paleontologist and an anthropologist, what are they looking for when they dig in the ground? Are they looking for the same thing that a geologist is looking for? No, they're looking for something that communicates intelligent design. For an anthropologist, they might come across some arrowheads. Now, if I saw that laying on the ground, I would walk right over it and just assume that it was just a rock. Now, do anthropologists tell you that? No, you can find these kinds of things in museums all over the world with dates that go back 5,000-6,000 years. These exact arrowheads are actually dated to 2,500 to 3,000 BC in that range. Old. And they say, what? Those rocks aren't just rocks. People made those. Now, wouldn't you have to ask them, how do you know that people made those? Because they are complex and highly specified for a purpose. And they can take a rock and take an arrowhead and go, this is an arrowhead and this is a rock. So clearly, there's the understanding that specified and complex information is detectable in nature. So that's the next question is, can we be certain that something that is designed, the result of intelligence, be detected? And the answer, of course, is yes. When complex and specified information is exhibited. They call this CSI. Go ahead and bring up the next part. Now, see these letters? That's a complex list of letters, correct? It's very complex. But is it specific? No. If I rearrange the information, although it's complex, and when I say complex, it's not just all C's or all periods like we see in nature. It's complex, but it's not specified. Here's what it means to have specified complexity. I rearrange the letters, and now I've communicated something that demonstrates The complex is now specified. So that's why we mean by CSI. It's actually a mathematical equation that philosophers and scientists who are creationists have been working on to say, how can we test a rock, a car, a building, or anything in it that exists and apply a number, a value to it, what they call the CSI value. And this is as scientific as they're trying to say, this is a legitimate science. We're going to take anything, a book, anything you can find in that exists, and say, if we plug in the numbers, what is its CSI value? How complex and how specified? And if it has a high enough CSI value, there's a mark that takes it from being intelligent or non-intelligent, random chance or physical law, to intelligently caused. In other words, if I go out into the desert and I find a watch, its CSI value is going to be a lot higher than the clouds in the sky that looks kind of like a horse. I don't think that's really somebody drawing a horse in the sky. I think that was produced by chance coupled with physical laws. But the watch, its CSI value will be much higher. All right, so put that in the back of your brain there. Now, here are other fields that employ this concept that no one questions the validity of, but utilize this concept of intelligent design. The SETI Institute, the NASA's research, which is no longer associated with NASA anymore. NASA's been done away with it for a long time, but it originally started as a part of NASA, and it was the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And so this is one of their arrays that just recently, I think, went under out of lack of funding that they built. But they have basically, since the 70s, have, or maybe even before that, thought if we listen in on this background noise in the universe is actually makes noise in all different kinds of wavelengths, light, so on and so forth, different ways of measuring these signals. And what they're listening for, well, that's a good question, actually. What are they listening for? I'll ask you. They're looking for intelligent life. And what are the next one? How would they know if they actually heard something that was of an intelligent origin? And they tell you right on their website. They say, we would look for the existence of coded information on the signal. Okay, great. Now, how many of you saw the movie Contact? Yeah, it was an interesting movie. Now, in the movie, they discovered such a signal. Now, nothing like this has actually happened yet. But in the movie, they heard a signal that had a pattern. You don't find patterns in randomness, in things that happen by chance. And the pattern was prime numbers from 2 to 101. And then it would repeat again. And they thought, this cannot have happened by chance. There is no physical law in the universe that we know that will make sounds in the form of prime numbers and beeps and whatever not. So this must be an intelligent source. In the film, they do that. And so what they're really saying is that something that is complex and specified information equals the result of intelligence. Now let's look at the next example. The genetic code. DNA. DNA is really the building blocks of all life on Earth. I would say in the universe, but right now we don't have any proof that any life exists anywhere outside of planet Earth yet. But we'll just say that all life on Earth, as far as we know, is structured by DNA. Go ahead and show this. Now, a DNA is two strands of information connected to by these little prongs. They call them like the ladder, whatnot. And you might be able to see on the screen there that each little prong has a letter. So go on to the next slide. Now, the specified information of DNA is what we've discovered is there's basically four letters of information. And out of these four letters, you have to make three-letter words. And each word makes up a sentence. Now, this is what microbiology has discovered about our DNA. And thousands of sentences make up a gene. And, of course, we have thousands of genes that, that make up more than 1.5 million species of life on Earth. Now, the human being has, 46 chromosomes? And each chromosome is made up of so many DNA strands, trillions and trillions of DNA strands. And in, I think, 2002 or 2003, Time Magazine published an article talking about the Human Genome Project, where they finally mapped out the human DNA to see how many codes of letters, I guess you could say, how much information was in one DNA strand. And we have trillions of them in our bodies and make up who we are as human beings. Now, they said it was 3.1 billion letters. Now, imagine if I gave you four letters and said, I want you to communicate the necessary code to make 1.5 million species of life, plants and animals and so on. So here you go. Here's your four letters, and I want you to write the code. That's quite a task. And yet that's exactly what we've discovered about human DNA. So they, in the article, made this little life's twisted DNA's like a book. In fact, there are, I think, 800... Bring it up on the screen. I can't remember. There's like 800 Bibles. There's, I forget how many letters are in a Bible. It's like a few million, something like that. If you were to take your Bible and count every single letter, it's quite a lot. And in order to make a baby, you would need 800 Bibles of letters, of information, of data assembled in a complex and specified way to make a baby. So that means that every DNA strand, and there are trillions in a human being that make us up, that's how much information is required to make human beings and any other kind of life. Viruses, I think, only have one strand. But everything is highly specified information. And when we look at this, how do we not see this as the most powerful argument for intelligence? Now, some people have thought, well, maybe life did come from intelligence, like alien life, and the Earth was seeded. They call this directed panspermia. The idea that, yes, you're right, life could not have originated on Earth by chance. It's impossible. They've never been able to come up with an actual theory for how life began. I was watching debates with some of the foremost atheists today, even in recent months, and they're still, yeah, we don't know, but the idea of it just happening by accident is so exciting, and we can't wait to figure it out. Wait, what? So some people have given up the fight and say, yeah, aliens did it, or some other kind of life. But that begs the question, where did they come from? Because everything is contingent. Just because we can explain how life on Earth arrived does not tell us how life in the universe arrived. In fact, there are several pre-existing conditions, over 100, that we'll cover more when we cover atheism, that are necessary in the universe to allow for any kind of life imaginable. And if you tweak these initial conditions by the slightest degree, life in the universe, by any stretch of the imagination, is impossible. And so you have this set of conditions and circumstances in the universe that just basically say, this is a life-permitting universe. And if we change anything, life is not possible. And we'll talk more about that when we talk about atheism, because that'll be a lot of fun. So, as Bill Gates of Microsoft said, DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any software we've ever, what did he say? Created. You mean software doesn't create itself? Do you mean to tell me that all those thousands of employees, those software engineers, you need them? Can't you just throw this information out in a lake of computerness and just have it write itself? No, because it's complex and it's specified. When we talk about atheism, we'll talk about irreducible complexity, I hope, because that's really awesome. Don't forget that word, Bo. We need to talk about irreducible complexity. So, finally, the structure of the DNA. What are our three options? We've got letters, words that make sentences, and these sentences make blueprints that make people, animals, plants, cells, clearly by design. I've heard so many whacked out weird theories, but I've not heard a really decent response to this type of CSI factor. Off the charts compared to an arrowhead, really? Or a random signal from space that you're hoping one day we'll have enough specified information that you can say came from intelligent life? And that you're going to look at the letters, words, sentences, and blueprints that make up the very nature of our physical bodies and say that somehow that happened randomly? And someone might say, well, clearly, given enough time, let's say if you had 1 million years and 1 million monkeys banging on typewriters, eventually they would type out Shakespeare. How many of you have heard that argument? Well, the original proposed test was, there's several factors they failed to mention. One is there was an intelligent computer that every time the monkeys hit a letter that corresponded to the next letter necessary in a work of Shakespeare, the computer would take it and put it aside. Bang, 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 bang. Oh, there's another letter. Bang, bang, bang. Oh, there's another letter. It's a complete fallacious test and argument. It requires intelligence to recognize when a random letter is hit that corresponds. But if they are just left hitting random keyboards, the probability of them actually typing out, you would need infinite time. The probability is so astronomical that it for all intents and purposes, is impossible. So the analogy is sort of now a rhetoric and sort of almost like folklore. You know, when I was growing up, I was told that a frog turning into a prince was a fairy tale. I never imagined that going to high school, being taught that a frog turning into a prince was science. I don't know. We'll talk more about that when we talk about atheism and the question of origins. That's not our purpose today. Purpose today is to see if there's a fingerprint of an intelligent designer in the universe. I think this is a strong argument for that case. So when we look at the infinite personal God, how do we know then who this God is? Okay, so we have a fingerprint in the universe and in life itself, that there must be an infinite and personal creator that exists outside of the contingent universe. Everything has a beginning, so it must have a cause. So we need something that doesn't have a beginning, doesn't require a cause, it's necessary. There are only three major faiths that adhere to this concept of God. Christianity, in all its branches, cults and otherwise, Judaism, and Islam. These are the predominant, what we call, monotheistic faiths or religions. Now, can I know who the personal creator is? These are the three faiths on the table. Is there a fingerprint that I can look at that will tell me who this personal creator is? And I believe the question is, yes, there is, in history. Now, here's what sets Christianity apart, and this is a strong argument, I believe, is that when we go back to our little creation analogy with God, personal, infinite, see, Judaism and Islam both agree that there's an infinite and personal God that exists. They see the evidence and see, yes, there must be an intelligent creator, but the only evidence they have is that God spoke, as claimed. Whether you believe either one or the other or not is irrelevant at this point. It's not the purpose of our discussion here. But we have no way of knowing because it's just a human being saying God spoke to me. That doesn't show me really any fingerprint of God in history other than your saying that God spoke to you. But here's what's so unique about God's fingerprint in history in Christianity. See, in Christianity, God ceased from being invisible. He ceased from being intangible. He ceased being eternally elusive, and he put on flesh and he entered into our finite, dependent, contingent universe. He walked and talked with us, among us, so that we could actually get an idea of what this creator was really like. There is no other faith, no other religious doctrine that has such a clean-cut claim in the sense that in the same manner as Christianity does with Jesus Christ. So our excitement now, when I, of course, you know, when I started thinking about whether or not God existed in my teenage years and was just gripped with the fact that, you know, I really couldn't say that my moral actions were meaningful because I don't have a basis for right and wrong. I mean, if there's no God, there's no judge. There's no reason for me to not steal. I mean, when I was at daycare, I remember going and stealing, I think it was $27 out of the little box that the lady had. And my mom, I fell asleep in the car and my mom decided to take me into bed. And I was like all happy that I had this $27 in my pocket. I didn't know it was $27. I was like six. And I woke up in the middle of the night and I was in my little chonies, my little short, my little underwear. And I was like, freaked out. I just yelled, "Mom, where's my pants?" And I started freaking out. "Where'd you put my pants? Where'd you put?" She's like, "Why?" And so she just picks them up and looks in the pocket and goes, "Where'd you get all this cash?" And the next day I got busted and I had to go apologize and take the money back to the daycare. But, you know, ultimately as an adult, now obviously I got caught and that was embarrassing. And I wouldn't want to steal ineffectively so as to get caught. But in this case, you know, in the end, though, what if I could have gotten away with it? What if I had not freaked out and just cleverly took the money and put it? I mean, there was a ton of us kids sleeping. And I was sleeping on my mat like so many kids do it when your parents work late at daycare. It's one of those late night daycare places. And so it could have been any one of us kids. They would have never known other than there was $27 missing. Some kid took it. I would have had so much fun at the arcade because back then it required quarters, unfortunately. but why would my moral actions have any kind of responsibility? So for me, it was just, gosh, then my life just wouldn't mean anything. And there has to be more to life than what you see, hear, taste, touch, and smell. And so when someone first communicated to me, another magician, in fact, the idea, I could really relate to the Apostle John's excitement when he proclaimed in his writing, he says, "We proclaim to you the one who existed from the beginning, whom we have heard and seen. We saw him with our own eyes and touched him with our own hands. He is the word of life." What did Jesus say to his disciples when most of them forsook him and fled? When he spoke some difficult words, what did Peter say? Well, he said, "Why are you guys still here? You're the only one that has words of eternal life. You're the only one that can give my life meaning. You're the only one that matters." And so when I became a Christian, the reason I went into ministry is because all of a sudden this black and white reality check took place. Okay, if there is no God, life literally is meaningless. I could do whatever I want. It really wouldn't make a single bit of difference. I might as well just do whatever feels good. As Malcolm Muggeridge said, it's either, if I can remember the quote right, it's either megalomania or erotomania. The drive for pleasure or the drive for power. The clenched fist or the phallus. Hitler or Hugh Hefner. In the end, that's really all there is to life. Yeah, what a misery. What if you couldn't even get either of those? You're just, you know, like, hard up and living in a, born in a third world country where you just, you know, I've seen him at so many, wow. But here, you mean to tell me that there are words of eternal life? That my existence doesn't end in nothing, but lives on for eternity? Now, my thoughts, my actions, my decisions, my beliefs have eternal weight. So discovery number two, Christianity alone claims we can know that God exists because he came to earth physically as a man over 2,000 years ago. In the person of Jesus Christ. Now, is there any questions? We're going to take our, in a few minutes we'll have lunch, but we're going to take a break here momentarily. I'd like to take the last 5 to 10 minutes before we break for lunch to just open it up for some dialogue, some questions, some thoughts, anything that I might have said that confused you or maybe some challenges you might have to what I shared. But the next module is, what we're going to ask is, do we have a record of the life of Jesus that's trustworthy? If the claim is that God came into human history, which is what we're suggesting. We've seen the need. We've seen one of the fingerprints for God's existence in nature. But this other fingerprint of God actually operating in human history, do we have a record? And what would that record need to look like to show us that God did in fact come into our reality, walk and talk among us, demonstrating his genuine existence as a personal and infinite creator?